Blog Talk Radio. Greetings. This is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Friday, March 8th, 2024, International Women's Day. And we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, a special worldwide radio broadcast. Later on in our program, we will bring you our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the silence within the Western media on the plight of Palestinian women on International Women's Day. Yemen's leaders have condemned the United States for supplying negligible aid and tons of weapons to bomb Gaza. 25% of African-American women in a recent poll say that reproductive rights are a major issue. And there are problems in the implementation of the redistricting legislation upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in the state of Alabama. In the second and third hours, we will focus on recent developments in Palestine. We'll have a panel discussion rebroadcast from Electronic Intifada, one of the primary sources on the situation in Palestine and throughout West Asia. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude with the Kalsum Orchestra. This is from a 1967 concert, and Kalsum, one of the legendary Egyptian classical music vocalists. Let's listen to a concert from 1967.
سيداتي وسادتي السلام عليكم ورحمة الله مع الوصلة الثالثة في حفل الليلة الساهر الكبير الذي تحييه كوكب الشرق السيدة أم كلثوم وننقله لكم من دار سينما قصر النيل في القاهرة مرة ثالثة نحييكم من القاهرة من المدينة الساهرة من المدينة التي استحال كل ما فيها إلى ضوء وإلى نغم مع رحلة عميقة العطاء ثرة بالأشواق خصبة بالمشاعر النبيلة كان لقاء الليلة في وصلتين متعاقبتين غنت فيهما كوكب الشرق الأطلال وفكروني ومع الأغنيتين ومع اللحنين لرياض السنباطي ولمحمد عبد الوهاب كانت النشوة الغامرة التي تملأ جوانح جمهور الحاضرين الذين امتلأت بهم دار سينما قصر النيل وكان هذا التجاوب الحار العميق الذي طالما استمعنا إليه وعشنا معه ونحن نتابع حفلات كوكب الشرق حفلا بعد حفل شهرا بعد شهر وعاما بعد عام لكن لقاء الليلة سيداتي وسادتي في إطار من الأعياد المجيدة في إطار من إطلالة العام الجديد ومن ليلات رمضان المباركة المليئة بالنور الحافلة بالخير وفي إطار من الأعياد المجيدة التي تصدح من خلالها نواقيس السلام كل هذه المعاني الكبرى التي تملأ بالفرحة والغبطة قلوبكم وقلوب الحاضرين هنا في هذا المكان كانت كوكب الشرق تتويجا لفرحته وتتويجا للسعادة الغامرة والنشوة العميقة التي امتلأت بها القلوب والجوانح وهي تتابع فن أم كلثوم وعطاء أم كلثوم لحظة بلحظة وقطرة بقطرة ونهلة بنهلة. وفي هذه الوصلة الثالثة من حفل الليلة الساهر ستغني كوكب الشرق أغنية للصبر حدود التي كتبها الشاعر الغنائي عبد الوهاب محمد ولحنها الفنان الأصيل محمد الموجي. وفي لقائنا مع أغنية للصبر حدود تتم لقاءات الليلة الثلاثة بين ألوان شتى من اللحن والنغم يحملها جميعا أداء أم كلثوم العميق الطليق الرائع المبدع، ويرتفع بنا من خلالها شدو أم كلثوم الآسر الغامر. سيداتي وسادتي، وتسلط الأضواء على المسرح وتنفرج الستار في هذه اللحظة عن كوكب الشرق أم كلثوم ومن خلفها الفرقة الموسيقية لتقدم وصلتها الثالثة في حفل الليلة مع كوكب الشرق أم كلثوم في أغنية للصبر حدود، كلمات عبد الوهاب محمد وتلحين محمد الموجي.
معيون وعمود ما تصبرنيش بوعود وكلام معسول وعود ما تصبرنيش بوعود وكلام معسول وعود انا يا مصبر زمان زمان على نار وعذاب وهوان انا يا مصبر زمان زمان على نار وعذاب وهوان وهي غلطة ومش حسود ولو للصبر حدود يا thank you. كتير وداريت في القلب كتير نفسك وديت لك وقت تفكر أكتر من مرة سبتك وديت لك وقت تفكر أكتر من مرة وقت تفكر كان قلبي كبير بيسامحك إنما كان غدرك أكبر أكبر من طيبة قلبي أكبر من طولة بالي أكبر من طيبة قلبي أكبر من أكبر من طولة بالي أكبر من طيبة قلبي أكبر من طولة بالي أكبر من قوة ربي مع كل الماضي
إنما كان غير
أدرك أكبر أكبر من طيبة قلبي أكبر من طولة بالي أكبر من طيبة قلبي أكبر من طولة بالي أكبر من نور ربي مع كل البعض الغالي ولقيتني وانا بغوار خلصت الصبر معاك للصبر حدود للصبر حدود يا حبيبي ولو
وهكذا سيداتي سادتي كنتم معها في وصلتها الغنائية الثالثة التي قدمت فيها في ختام حفل الليلة الساهر أغنية للصبر حدود من كلمات عبد الوهاب محمد وتلحين محمد الموجي. وهكذا سيداتي سادتي كنتم مع الفن العربي الأصيل، سمة هذا الفن يروينا دائما بغير حدود، لكنه يتركنا أيضا ظماء بغير حدود. بقدر ما يحملنا إلى مشارف النجوم فإنه يفتح أمام أبصارنا وأمام أعماقنا طاقات أخرى في انتظار أن ترتوي وأن تمتلئ وأن يملأها فن متجدد دائم، هو فن كوكب الشرق السيدة أم كلثوم. سيداتي وسادتي، ساهم في نقل هذا الحفل الساهر إليكم من الزملاء المهندس محمد عبد المنعم الشافعي، ومن غرفة المراقبة الزملاء وديد شاكر، عبد القادر بطاح، مصطفى عبد اللطيف، سيد رمضان، حسام فهمي وحلم رسمي، ومن هندسة الإذاعة الخارجية مسعود مشرقي، أحمد خلو الدين، محمد سامي السيد، محمود خليل، ومحمد السمان. سيداتي وسادتي، من القاهرة المدينة الساهرة التي لم تنم بعد، نحييكم في ختام حفل ليلة الساهر الذي أحيته كوكب الشرق السيدة أم كلثوم، ونقلناه لكم من دار سينما قصر النيل في القاهرة. وحتى يجمعنا لقاء قادم، نرجو لكم دائما أوقاتا مليئة بالبهجة، حافلة بالأمل، وتصبحون على خير.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. This special worldwide radio broadcast for Friday, March 8th, 2024, and we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We just heard the music, the voice of the legendary Umm Kalsum. That was a live concert broadcast over Radio Cairo in 1967. Right now, we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment. Our lead story deals with the plight of women in the Gaza Strip, which has been bombarded for the last 5 months by the Israeli Defense Forces with the support of the United States military and administration. The spokesperson for the Ministry of Health in Gaza puts out an urgent appeal to women's rights organizations and the international community on the eve of International Women's Day. The international community denies Palestinian women their rights and remains silent about the ongoing Israeli violations against them. The spokesperson for the Ministry of Health in Gaza, Ashraf Al-Kudra, stated on the eve of the International Women's Day. Al-Kudra added that the silence of the international community has contributed to the genocide against Palestinian women, their children, and families at the hands of the Israeli occupation forces. Acts which have garnered military or diplomatic support from the United States and Europe. He pointed out that Palestinian women, especially in the Gaza Strip, are experiencing the worst humanitarian catastrophe, which includes mass murder, displacement, detention, countless abortions, epidemics, and deaths. Al-Kudra called on the United Nations to take immediate action to halt the Israeli aggression and genocide against the Palestinian women and their families. He also urged institutions focused on women's rights to stand in solidarity with Palestinian women and mobilize efforts to demand an end to Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip. He also called on these organizations to promote the health, psychological, and social needs of Palestinian women, especially in the Gaza Strip. In other news, Saeed Abdul Malik Al-Houthi discusses the latest regional developments and highlights the crucial role of supporting fronts and aiding Gaza. The U.S. provides tons of weapons to kill Palestinians in Gaza, while it attempts to deceive the public by sending negligible amounts of aid to the Strip via airdrops, the leader of the Yemeni Ansarullah movement, Saeed Abdul Malik Al-Houthi, has said during his weekly address, which was given yesterday. Saeed Al-Houthi emphasized that the U.S. is impending the delivery of aid through land and sea routes and airports to the Gaza Strip. The U.S. bears shame and disgrace, playing a primary role in the Israeli crimes against the Palestinians in Gaza. The situation is disgraceful for the international community, which turns a blind eye to these crimes, the leader of the movement emphasized on Thursday. Saeed al-Houthi pointed to the ongoing fierce confrontations launched by the Palestinian resistance against Israeli occupation forces in the Gaza Strip, saying that the enemy faces a moral breakdown experienced by its troops in Gaza as the command fails to achieve its goals, including retrieving captives and eliminating the resistance. The leader of the Yemeni resistance said that the U.S. and Israel attempts to exploit a temporary ceasefire during the Ramadan to bypass a complete cessation of the aggression on the Gaza Strip. He stressed that there is no genuine peaceful policy that the Americans or the Israelis employ in their relations with any Arab country, adding that the U.S.-Israeli-Western agendas aim to control the nations via normalization processes. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. News from the United States, more than a quarter of women black voters describe abortion as their top issue in this year's presidential election. A poll that was released yesterday from health policy research firm KFF reveals the findings signal a significant shift from previous election years when white conservative evangelicals were more likely to peg abortion and their biggest priority when voting. Those voters were highly motivated in recent presidential elections to cast ballots for Donald Trump, who promised to appoint U.S. Supreme Court judges who would take away the constitutional right to an abortion. But just months ahead of the first presidential election, since the court overturned Roe v. Wade in June 2022, that voting dynamic is drastically changing. KFF's poll suggests it's a corporate shift, said Angeli Kersinga, a KFF poster. Abortion voters are young, black women, and are not white evangelicals. Overall, 12% of voters surveyed said abortion was the most important issue in this year's election. Certain women voters, however, were more likely to identify the issue as top of mind. They include 28% of African-American women, 19% of women living in states where abortion is banned, and 17% of women who are under the age of 50. And finally, in the state of Alabama, more than 6,000 voters in a newly formed congressional district drawn to heighten black voting power in Alabama received postcards with incorrect voting information ahead of just this last past Tuesday's primary. Alarming advocates concerned about the potential impact on a race seen as crucial to boosting black representation and Democrats' hopes to flip the U.S. House in November. James Snipes, chair of the Montgomery County Board of Registers, said that 6,593 county voters received postcards listing the incorrect congressional district after the county election software misidentified some people living in the second congressional district as living in the seventh. Snipes said voters arriving at the polls were still able to vote correct candidates. The county had sent about 2,000 notices to affected voters as of Tuesday evening and will send out an additional 4,000 on Wednesday. Everyone who came to their precinct was able to vote for correct candidates, Snipes said, attributing the incorrect information to a software glitch made when adjusting to the recent shift in state congressional districts. This was a good faith effort. With that, we'll conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we would like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches and hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you would like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. All you need to do is go to the Pan-African Newswire website, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you would like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Friday, March 8th, 2024, go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That is at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. Detroit's own with the track entitled Love Is Here, But Now You're Gone. This is the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for Friday, March the 8th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we want to move into a Palestinian update with the Electronic Intifada. This is the sixth month IDF siege upon Gaza. Let's listen to an update from Electronic Intifada, one of the primary sources on the situation in Palestine.
Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Thursday, March 7th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abu Nima, Asa Wynn-Stanley, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 153 of Israel's genocide in Gaza as we enter the sixth month. We have another packed show for you today, including an interview with a pediatric critical care specialist who just got back from Gaza, where he was treating babies and children in intensive care. Also, we'll be joined by journalist Bryce Green to discuss the role of corporate media in shielding the U.S. public from Israel's official narrative of October 7th. And we'll have a full roundup of videos from the Palestinian Armed Resistance with John Elmer. But first, some of the news that we've been covering at the Electronic Intifada. At least 20 people, including elders and children, have died as a result of Israel's accelerating engineered starvation of the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry reported on Wednesday that those 20 counted deaths reflect only those who were able to reach hospitals. Quote, we believe that dozens are dying silently as a result of starvation without reaching hospitals, said the ministry's spokesperson, Dr. Ashraf Al-Kedra. He added earlier in the day on Wednesday that, quote, the famine is deepening and will claim thousands of citizens if the aggression is not stopped and humanitarian and medical aid does not immediately enter. The Israeli army has not stopped shelling and sniping Palestinians waiting for food trucks and humanitarian aid in northern Gaza. Last Thursday, February 29th, as Maureen Claire Murphy reported, 112 Palestinians were killed and another 760 injured after Israeli forces opened fire toward Palestinians who had gathered to receive food aid in Gaza City. Quote, hunger is particularly acute in the bombed out northern half of Gaza, including Gaza City, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians remain after Israel ordered the forced displacement of people from the area months earlier, Maureen reports. Quote, Palestinians in the north of Gaza are now starving as Israel has prevented the UN from delivering aid there for more than a month. The food aid massacre in Gaza City is a, quote, flagrant violation of international humanitarian law and fully goes against the International Court of Justice's provisional measures ordering Israel to halt genocidal actions, said Petra de Sutter, a deputy prime minister in Belgium last Thursday. The Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor said that at around 4:30 a.m. on February 29th, Israeli tanks shelled, quote, a crowd of thousands of hungry civilians who had been waiting hours for aid trucks to arrive. Maureen Claire Murphy adds in her report that, quote, the rights group has documented previous cases in which Israeli troops opened fire toward and killed people awaiting aid. Daniel Hagari, the chief Israeli military spokesperson, said during a press conference that the trucks were part of a convoy carrying aid from Egypt that was screened at the Kerem Shalom crossing, quote, and then entered Gaza for distribution by private contractors. He claimed that tanks were present to, quote, secure the humanitarian corridor for the aid convoy, and that troops, quote, cautiously tried to disperse people as people he described as, quote, a mob, who rushed the trucks with a few warning shots. Hagari attempted to deflect responsibility by saying that the tank commander, quote, decided to retreat to avoid harm to the thousands of Gazans that were there, and claimed that no Israeli military strike was conducted toward the aid convoy. But as Maureen reports, the massacre was applauded by Israeli Public Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and celebrated on popular Hebrew language Telegram channels. A majority of Jewish Israelis opposed the transfer of humanitarian aid to Gaza. In a statement published on its Telegram channel, Hamas rejected the Israeli spokesperson's claims as baseless lies intended, quote, to cover up this heinous crime and to evade widespread international condemnation. Ashraf Al-Kedra, spokesperson for the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza, accused Israel of carrying out a premeditated massacre. Read more about last Thursday's flour bag massacre in Maureen Claire Murphy's report, Palestinians Seeking Food Aid Killed as Israel Starves Gaza, on electronicintifada.net. Since last Thursday's massacre, Israel continued killing starving Palestinians waiting for food trucks in northern Gaza. On Monday, the Palestinian Health Ministry reported that Israeli forces committed a massacre in Gaza City, leaving dozens who were waiting for food trucks wounded and dead. At least 9 people were killed and many others were wounded in an Israeli strike on an aid distribution truck in Deir el-Balah earlier in the day. Al Jazeera's Tariq Abu Azoum, reporting from Rafah, said, quote, "It seems that the Israeli military is right now targeting people who are waiting desperately for food, for anything to survive." And yesterday, at least 4 people were killed and dozens were wounded when Israeli tanks opened fire on people gathering for aid deliveries on Rashid Street in Gaza City. Earlier in the day, the United Nations World Food Program announced that it had attempted to resume delivering aid to northern Gaza, sending more than a dozen trucks. But Israeli occupation forces stopped the convoy at the Wadi Gaza checkpoint, separating northern and southern Gaza, for several hours before refusing entry. The World Food Program said that, quote, "airdrops are only a last resort to reach northern Gaza. Road routes are the only way to bring in the large quantities of food desperately needed to avert famine." For comparison, this week's airdrops only consisted of 6 tons of food, while this week's failed 14-truck convoy would have consisted of 200 tons. Ali Abu Nima and Tamara Nassar reported on Sunday that the airdrops, in which the U.S., Egypt, the U.K., the Netherlands, the United Arab Emirates, France, and Jordan have participated, instead of forcing Israel to open the crossings and stop preventing aid trucks from unloading their cargo safely, are being marketed, quote, as benevolent assistance amounting to humanitarian aid theater that does nothing to end the systematic and intentional campaign of starvation Israel and its American and European allies, with the complicity of regional regimes, are waging against Palestinians. The effect, whether intentional or not, is to relieve Israel and its backers of pressure to lift the total siege Tel Aviv has imposed on the coastal enclave with the clear intent of causing maximum suffering and death to as many people as possible, Ali and Tamara write. They add that, quote, "Tel Aviv knows that in practical terms, these drops will not substantially interfere with its policy of deliberately starving Palestinians to death. But it is happy with the propaganda imagery falsely suggesting that people in Gaza are receiving significant assistance." COGAT, the bureaucratic arm of Israel's military occupation, bragged last week that, quote, "an airdrop operation successfully delivered 160 packages of food and medical supplies to residents of southern Gaza and to the Jordanian field hospital in Khan Yunus." Ali and Tamara write that, quote, "in addition to preventing all but a handful of aid trucks from entering Gaza, Tel Aviv is allowing mobs of Zionist fanatics to stage rallies blocking aid trucks carrying vital supplies from entering Gaza. These genocidal racists are encamped in tents and enjoy the protection of the Israeli army. They are even hosting outdoor dance parties." For more, read Ali Abu Nima and Tamara Nassar's latest feature, "Demeaning Airdrops Over Gaza Are Humanitarian Aid Theater," on electronicintifada.net. Meanwhile, the United Nations Women's Agency reports that, quote, "an estimated 9,000 women have been reportedly killed by Israeli forces in Gaza to date. This figure is likely an underestimate, as many more women are reported to be dead under the rubble." The UN Women's report adds that, quote, "every day the war in Gaza continues. At the current rate, an average of 63 women will continue to be killed. An estimated 37 mothers are killed every day, leaving their families devastated and their children with diminished protection. More than 4 out of 5 women, or 84%, report that their family eats half or less of the food they used to before the war began, with mothers and adult women being those tasked with sourcing food, yet eating last, less, and least than everyone else. The Geneva-based Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor has released a new report documenting how Israeli tanks have deliberately run over dozens of Palestinian civilians alive. The human rights group documented the Israeli army's killing of a Palestinian man, quote, who was deliberately run over in Gaza City's El Zeitun neighborhood on February 29th after he was arrested. The man was subjected to harsh interrogation by members of the Israeli army, who bound his hands with plastic zip-tie handcuffs before running him over with a military vehicle from the bottom to the top of his body. The victim's mutilated body and the surrounding area bear obvious signs that a military bulldozer or tank was present, the report adds. Quote, it appears that the victim was purposefully stripped of his clothes as he was seen wearing only his underwear at the time of his death. Euromed Monitor explained that this killing was just the latest in a series of violations that include the destruction of civilian property in Gaza. These acts, the group said, quote, are part of a larger Israeli effort to dehumanize every Palestinian in the Gaza Strip in order to justify and normalize the crimes being committed against them. Crushing civilians with tanks is just one of the many cruel ways the Israeli army murders Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, disregarding their humanity, suffering, and dignity. The Tel Aviv newspaper Haaretz reported this week that the Israeli army is using robotic dogs and self-driving militarized bulldozers in the Gaza Strip. Quote, in an effort to avoid harming soldiers and dogs, the IDF has been experimenting with the use of robots and remote-controlled dogs in the Gaza war. Most of the tests have been with a robot dog, which is also equipped with a drone and can replace or reinforce the Oketz units' dogs in certain situations. Unmanned remote-controlled D9 bulldozers are also being used, Haaretz reports. The robot dog is made by Philadelphia-based Ghost Robotics and cost $130,000 each. Haaretz says that, quote, for the first time, the Panda, the remote-controlled D9 bulldozer jointly developed by Israel Aerospace Industries subsidiary Elta Systems, the IDF Ground Forces Technology Division, and the Defense Research and Development Directorate has been used in the Gaza war. The D9 is remotely operated by a screen and a joystick to carry out missions to expose ground and demolish buildings without jeopardizing soldiers, end quote. And finally, Tamara Nassar reports that, quote, Israel is escalating its provocations against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank in the wake of the holy month of Ramadan, despite claims that it is attempting to prevent further escalation. Earlier this week, Israeli occupation forces conducted one of the largest military raids in Ramallah in years, Tamara reported. Quote, Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank bear the brunt for such military raids, where the unlawful killing of Palestinian children is the norm, according to Defense for Children International Palestine, which collects field reports on Israel's killing of children. Israeli troops and settlers have killed 27 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of the year. This includes two teenage U.S. citizens. This past week, Tamara reports, Israeli forces killed three Palestinian children in the West Bank, including Mohammed Khaled Zaid, 13 years old, who was shot three times in his back and thigh while standing near a United Nations-run school by the entrance to the Jalazun refugee camp. When his friend, who was also injured, went to seek help, soldiers took Mohammed's body. An hour later, quote, they returned his body to the sidewalk near the entrance of the camp, reported Defense for Children International Palestine. Tamara also reports that, quote, on Wednesday, Israeli authorities approved tenders for thousands of homes in settlements across the occupied West Bank. Quote, this is the first time since June that the development of housing units in the West Bank have been advanced, Tel Aviv Daily Haaretz said. The head of the Israeli military's central command has also granted authorization for an Israeli outpost, illegal even under Israeli law, in the occupied West Bank to be transformed into a large settlement. If the plan is carried out, the outpost known as Mitzpeh Yehuda will be established as an official city settlement named Mishmar Yehuda. This would be an expansion of Israel's mega settlement of Male Adumim, adding more than 650 acres of stolen Palestinian land. For much more on the escalating situation in the occupied West Bank, read Tamara Nassar's latest report, Will Ramadan Tip the West Bank into Eruption, on electronicintifada.net. And you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. Coming up, we'll have journalist Bryce Green on to talk about the way the corporate media continues to peddle Israel's lies about October 7th. And we'll get a full update from John Elmer on the latest military developments from the resistance in Gaza. But first, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Arham Ali, pediatric critical care specialist at Loma Linda University Children's Hospital in Southern California. He just spent time in Gaza working at the Emirati Maternity Hospital in Rafah. Arham, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada live stream.
Thank you very much. It's an honor and privilege to be here and to communicate what I was able to do, what I was able to see, and to communicate the voices heard across the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you. Tell us a little bit about your specialty and the work you did in Gaza.
Sure, absolutely. By training, I'm a pediatric critical care intensivist. So I work in the pediatric ICU. I've been a physician for over 10 years as well, and I'm no stranger to trauma, to abuse, to burn injuries. This is something that I do day in and day out. I speak to families, I speak to siblings, I speak to patients regarding their severe injuries, regarding their risk of death, and I speak to family members after patients pass away as well, unfortunately. Specifically, when I was in Gaza, I was able to work in the Emirati Hospital, as you mentioned, and my specific role was to work in the neonatal ICU. So this is also an intensive care unit, but specifically restricted to premature children, to newborn babies, and to children primarily under 12 months of age as well.
I mean, over the last 5 months, we've been reporting on documenting the absolutely unspeakable situation, especially for children, especially for premature infants in the NICU and children in the PICU, the pediatric intensive care units across Gaza. Give us a sense of what you saw and what was needed for these very, very small and vulnerable children.
Thank you. Absolutely. I'll start off by stating that despite my years of training, my vocabulary does not encompass enough words to describe the atrocities and the devastation that's happening in Gaza right now for these young, innocent children, specifically for the newborn population. The hospital that I was working in the neonatal ICU, is now the largest functioning neonatal ICU in all of Gaza. And it's a 12-bed ICU, but quite often we will have up to 36, 40 patients inside of those 12 beds. So these patients are sharing incubators. They are in shared spaces, which you can imagine is devastating for infection control and for sepsis, and infection continues to spread. Many of the patients that I saw are patients that were either born just a little too early, prematurely, due to maternal stress, due to maternal malnutrition, due to maternal trauma, due to maternal dehydration. These children were born, anywhere in the 20 weeks to 38 weeks range, slightly premature. And many of them could have been treated and would have, beautiful lives. And we'd see them into adulthood with some assistance. And perhaps they would be on the next show and they would be our leaders for Palestine. But unfortunately, given the severe, severe lack of healthcare infrastructure due to the severe lack of essential medical supplies and equipment, these children that have survivable injuries, unfortunately now are unable to survive. Medications as simple as caffeine, it's a medication that's given either intravenously or orally, and it's given to premature children just to provide it as a stimulant to help them breathe. And this is a very common medication that's available here. It's very cheap, in the West, widely available. But unfortunately, due to the shortage and due to the blockade of supplies entering into Gaza, we saw countless patients, unfortunately, pass away from simple apnea or lack of stimulation to breathe. Many of these cases are extremely devastating because, there was one specific instance in which I remember speaking to a mother, and she said that after 14 years including IVF treatment, she finally had a child. And the child, had apnea prematurity, which the treatment is caffeine. The child was initially receiving it, but then unfortunately we ran out. And unfortunately this beautiful child ended up passing away. And it was absolutely devastating for the entire healthcare staff, for the family as well.
Dr. Arham, what we're seeing and what we're reading in terms of children starving to death. On Wednesday, the health ministry in Gaza said that 20 people have starved to death, including, according to the chief doctor at the Kamal Adwan Hospital, a baby that was one day old. Is it possible for a newborn baby to starve to death? What does it take for that to happen in terms of the health of the mother and the conditions that are around? Help us understand that.
Absolutely, Ali, and thank you for bringing that up. And I think you hit the nail on the coffin here in terms of focusing on maternal health. So yes, it is possible for a one-day child, to starve or to die from dehydration and malnutrition. But it stems from mom's nutrition. What was the maternal nutrition leading up or during the pregnancy? What was mother's nutrition peri-delivery? What were the circumstances of the delivery? Was there any bleeding that happened? Did the child require any blood transfusions, which are extremely limited? Was the child dehydrated? What kind of milk was the child able to have access to? Many of these mothers, unfortunately, given the stress, are unable to breastfeed their children, whether it's due to their own malnutrition and lack of nutrition, or whether it's due to the stress of the scenario, or many of these children are being born after their mothers have died, from some source of trauma. Even formula, preterm formula was a scarcity. We ran out of it and we were giving preterm children regular infant, a neonatal formula, which does not have the appropriate nutrition and minerals and essential components for nutrition. Lack of water is also a severe consequence of this aggression right now as well. Earlier in the aggression, there was a time in which the intensivists had access to formula, but unfortunately no clean water. And they were, to make the formula, they were mixing the formula with seawater. The amount of salt composition, you're essentially poisoning your patient. And, we did not go to medical school. We did not do our years of training to poison our patients and to actively kill them. These were the dire circumstances. And many, many children, newborn babies, young infants are dying simply because of malnutrition and lack of clean food and milk.
And for the infants who do somehow survive, these circumstances, what does chronic malnutrition and this engineered starvation that Israel is imposing on Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, what does it do to the body, to a growing, developing body, especially at such a young age? How does what Israel is doing now impact a child's entire life?
Yeah. So we know through lots of research and scientific analysis that children with restricted access to food, or those that are in food deserts, specifically here in the U.S., have chronic growth abnormalities. They have delayed neurocognition. They're unable to meet their maximum potential, both in terms of growth and in terms of neurocognition as well. They're at higher risk for infection. They are at overall at just a higher risk of morbidity and mortality. And food desert is a term that we use here in the United States, and it's one that refers to a lack of access to food due to or lack of access to healthy food. When we talk about Gaza in specific, I think it's a little bit more severe, you know, to say, you know, food desert is not the appropriate term. You know, this is inflicted starvation, targeted starvation for young, innocent children. These children are exposed to adverse childhood events. They will have long-term consequences if they're able to live into childhood, into toddlers, and eventually into teenagers and into adults. You know, the brain, the formation of the brain is very, very highly dependent on lipids and proteins and kind of the wiring connections. These are essential nutrients that are required. And if these children are unable to receive it, they will not be able to, you know, form healthy, good, beautiful brains, unfortunately.
Dr. Arham, talk about, you're at the Emirati Hospital, which is in Rafah. As we know, Rafah is the southernmost city in Gaza. It's where more than 1 million people are currently seeking safety and shelter, ordered to go there by Israel from other parts of Gaza. And Rafah has, of course, not been spared from aerial bombardment and attacks. But from what we hear, it is the least affected in comparison to the devastation in the north and some of the middle parts of Gaza. And Israel is threatening a full-scale attack on Rafah. Talk about the conditions at the hospital. What are you seeing? What would someone see walking into that hospital? And talk about the availability of supplies. You talked about basic medications running out. Are any supplies coming in? Is nothing coming in, or is it a trickle, or is it coming sporadically? Help us understand the reality on the ground.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'll go ahead and start off describing the environment surrounding the hospital as you're entering in. There are hundreds and thousands of tents surrounding the hospital. As traditionally speaking, hospitals are seen as a safe haven, and a safe area for people to reside in. Additionally, it's because there's so much trauma that's going on, if you are injured, it's in your best interest to be close to a hospital so that you can seek a healthcare assistance as quickly as possible. So there's hundreds of tents. There are children roaming the streets. There are adults roaming the streets. Unfortunately, because school is not in session right now, these children are not learning. They're trying their best to keep themselves occupied. Same with the parents as well. There's a lot of despair. There's, you know, when you look into, you know, the common man or woman's eyes, you see a lot of pain and a lot of suffering. They see you as a fresh outsider face, and they see hope. But ultimately, that hope is quite limited. You know, what we're doing is essentially just putting a Band-Aid on a deep wound that is going to scar, and, you know, a Band-Aid is not enough. As you enter into the hospital, you're surrounded by patients and their family members. As you're walking in through the gates as well, you can see lines in the outpatient department outside of the pharmacies for people trying to seek some form of pharmacological intervention. The hallways are lined with both patients and also with people just residing, you know, again, trying to seek shelter. The conditions are extremely unhygienic, unfortunately, given the circumstances, the lack of clean water, the lack of cleaning supplies. And as you make your way on up into the neonatal ICU, you can actually see a trail of individuals holding buckets because the hospital, traditionally speaking, will usually have some form of clean water available. So it's a very chaotic environment. It's one in which is full of desperation and an unrelenting sadness. In terms of supplies entering into the hospitals, entering into Rafah, I will say it's a very, very slow trickle. Extremely. And given the needs, you know, the population of Rafah prior to this aggression was around 200,000, if I'm quoting correctly, and now it's over 1 million. So, the needs are significantly higher, yet the supply is significantly less. So this is a recipe for disaster. It's a targeted recipe for disaster, unfortunately, and we're seeing it full on.
We just have a couple minutes left, Dr. Arham, but I wanted to ask you, when you came back to the U.S. and to Southern California, where you live and work and teach, how do you process what you've seen, and how does it inform your work back home?
As I mentioned earlier, you know, I'm no stranger to death, and unfortunately, it's not uncommon while I'm working in my ICU here in the U.S. that we'll pronounce a patient dead, and we have to move on to the next patient as quickly as possible because that's what the patients need and that's what the families need as well. They need our 100% attention. The scenario, the situation here coming back to the U.S. Is different. You know, those beautiful children, I see their faces at night. I can hear their voices. I can see their mothers if I close my eyes and think about them. So it certainly is quite challenging to be able to go back to the status quo or the norm. I'm incredibly grateful for the supplies and equipment and the personnel and the support that are available here in the U.S. And I can't help but, you know, to wonder and to think that if we were able to provide a little bit more aid, if more aid was allowed into Palestine, how different the situation would be for these indigenous civilians.
Well, we're going to leave it right there. Dr. Arham Ali, you're a pediatric critical care specialist at the Loma Linda University Children's Hospital in Southern California. Thank you so much for being with us and for going to Gaza and working alongside the heroic physicians and staff at the Emirati Maternity Hospital. Please keep us posted on your work.
And thank you for speaking about your experience, because I really hope that, you know, many of our colleagues who've come on the live stream have talked about, for example, the silence of the American Medical Association about the situation in Gaza. So I hope that many of your medical colleagues will hear what you have to say and what you've seen, and that bearing witness will be just as important as the work you did trying to help and heal people in Gaza.
Thank you very much. If I could just send a quick message to my colleagues here stateside, and that's, you know, specifically for the pediatricians across the U.S., you know, just as a reminder, we are mandated reporters, and that means that we have to report all suspected and known instances of trauma or abuse to children, whether it be patients that we're taking care of in front of us or across the globe. So this is just a gentle reminder that we need to stand up for these children against their abusers and continue to provide care with empathy and compassion.
That's beautifully said and so important. And I hope that your colleagues understand their mandate. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dr. Arham.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah.
And you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. I'm going to throw it to Ali Abunima and Asa Wynn-Stanley to introduce our next guest, Bryce Green.
Thanks, Nora. Well, hi, everybody. I'm Asa Wynn-Stanley. I'm here with Ali Abunima, and you are watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. Now, we are delighted to be joined by Bryce Green. Bryce is an organizer, writer, and contributor to the Media Watchdog, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. He's contributed to numerous independent media outlets, including the Electronic Intifada. Welcome, Bryce.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Hi, Bryce. It's nice that we've communicated in every way except face-to-face like this, so it's nice to finally do that.
Absolutely. It's good to see you both.
Thanks for coming on. And Bryce, your most recent analysis for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, is titled Shielding U.S. Public from Israeli Reports of Friendly Fire on October 7th. And you write that since October, the Israeli press has uncovered damning evidence showing that an untold number of the Israeli victims during the October 7th Hamas attack were in fact killed by the Israeli army. And you say that the Israeli army's responsibility for Israeli deaths has been a repeated topic of discussion in the Israeli press, accompanied by demands for investigations. But the most U.S. readers have gotten from their own press about the issue is a dismissive piece from the Washington Post about so-called October 7th truthers. Of course, you're referring there to the article we've talked about previously on this live stream, the hit piece on the Electronic Intifada, the Gray Zone, and other independent outlets who've done this kind of reporting. We've obviously reported extensively on this topic at the Electronic Intifada, as you've kindly acknowledged. But talk to us more about what you are seeing and not seeing in the Western media in terms of this question of friendly fire and perhaps other elements of what's happening in Gaza.
Absolutely. Most Americans have this image of their press as, obstinate and a challenging power and really trying to muckrake up real stories to help the American people understand the world better. But that doesn't square with the reality of actual media performance. As you say, in the Israeli press, things that challenge the official narrative of October 7th have been routinely reported and widely discussed. But in America, you very rarely see any discussion of this. And as you said, the most discussions you see of this are either glossing over it as not an issue or actively attacking the people who report on this sort of thing. Now, this is a strange phenomenon because in Israel, the press there is actually under military censorship. So one might expect that the press there would serve a more overt propaganda role than they do here in the United States, but that's not the case. Even without military censorship, American editors and journalists, they understand the areas that they're not supposed to go into. They understand the topics that they're not supposed to talk about, and they understand that they can easily get ahead if they attack the people who do talk about these sorts of things. And so the media in the United States has really served to engineer consent for Israel's brutal genocidal attack on Gaza. These reports about the friendly fire on October 7th, they're important because they challenge the narrative that all of these civilians that were killed on October 7th were killed by Hamas, and that the attack on October 7th was designed to kill as many civilians as possible. Reports from Hamas and reports from about these friendly fire incidents, they seem to at least challenge that narrative. But American journalists, even if they truly believe in the narrative that October 7th was an unequivocal terrorist attack, well, they don't seem to want to defend it by comparing their versions and other official versions with what's been coming out in the Israeli press. The instinct has been to suppress it and to attack those who do report on it. And so this goes along with all these other aspects of American media performance. It's become sort of a dark joke on the internet about every time these Western media outlets report on the death of a Palestinian, they'll use the passive voice and they'll abstract away any responsibility that Israel obviously has for these deaths. It'll be something like a Palestinian child struck by bullet during clashes or something like that. Whereas if they report on an Israeli death, it'll be Hamas killed this Israeli. And they know what they're doing. These people go to journalism school. They know what the effect might be on the American public, and they choose to report this way anyway. And it's hard to believe that this isn't intentional and that they're not actively embracing their role as cheerleaders for Israeli apartheid and genocide.
One of the things that's been admitted or at least discussed in Israel is the use of the Hannibal Directive on October 7th. Now, that's, as our viewers and listeners will most likely know because of our ongoing coverage of this, the Hannibal Directive is the Israeli military doctrine that allows their military forces to use any level of force necessary to prevent Israelis from being taken captive, even if that means killing those Israelis in the process. And that's in order to prevent an enemy from gaining bargaining chips that can be used to force Israel to release prisoners it may be holding. Bryce, have you seen U.S. media outlets, and particularly the New York Times, addressing the question of the Hannibal Doctrine?
I've yet to see the New York Times describe the Hannibal Doctrine in as many words. There have been scattered reports from the Times about how generals have ordered their troops to fire on areas where they know that Israeli civilians are being held. But this has been, again, glossed over. It's not been described as anything worth a headline. If it is discussed, it's discussed in several paragraphs down where editors and journalists know that people typically don't read to. And it's not emphasized and it's not opined on or remarked upon in any serious way. And so, again, this seems to be a deliberate campaign of suppressing the actual facts of the day of October 7th in favor of the official Israeli narrative.
Well, I mean, it's as you've pointed out, the U.S. media is to borrow a phrase, being more Catholic than the Pope, because as we've pointed out, these matters are discussed in the Israeli press. I mean, we shouldn't give the Israeli media too much credit. The vast majority of it is war propaganda and genocidal war propaganda. But nonetheless, we do see questions being raised in Israeli media that are just absent in the U.S. And the same is true in Canada, the U.K., and much of Europe, the so-called West. My question for you is, and you've talked about how journalists in the U.S. are doing it knowingly, and they seem to know what the limits are of what they're allowed to say. But my question is, I guess I have two questions. Who is the target of this propagandistic coverage? And is it working from the perspective of those doing it? I mean, how do you see the state of public opinion and the reaction to this coverage? I know that's a broad question, but what do you think the effect of it is?
Well, that's an important one. The idea that these articles, these propagandistic reports, are going to change the minds of people like you or me who have done the reading is just laughable. Anyone who has above a 10th grade reading level is able to read through these reports, check the facts against what the sources say, and weigh the evidence in a serious manner. But these articles aren't meant for those people. These articles are meant for the people who are either completely fanatics or just completely incurious about the actual facts of the matter. It's very easy for someone to see a headline attacking October 7th truthers and then see that as justification for them never to actually read the articles that challenge the official narrative, to never actually investigate for themselves what these reports say, what this UN report says, what all these civil commissions have been saying. The people who write these reports and write these articles, they understand that the majority of the public does not read these sorts of things. They understand that it's easy to poison or inoculate the public against these reports. And so they're not for serious people doing investigations. They're not for people who want to actually debate the facts in a serious manner. They're just meant to nudge people away from the truth and therefore support the Israeli line and the campaign that they're committing. It doesn't seem to be any doubt about that.
Yeah, I mean,
Asa, why don't we talk about Asa? Why don't you? I'd like to hear what Bryce thinks about the issue we've just written about and just published moments before this live stream. Why don't you talk? And this is also a chance to update the audience on a story, a scandal we've been covering. So Asa, why don't you tell, let's go into that.
Yeah, so closely related to the Israeli atrocity propaganda and the issue of the Israeli death toll, and as well as the issue of friendly fire and the Hannibal Doctrine that you know, you address in your piece, is the issue of Israel's debunked propaganda narrative that there was a campaign of mass rape carried out by Palestinians during the 7th of October military assault. And we've closely followed this story here on the live stream, and Ali has repeatedly debunked this narrative. And now Ali and I have written this new story with the latest on the issue, and you can see it on the screen here. UN report launders Israel's fraudulent mass rape propaganda. And it's, of course, it's about the new UN report by Pramila Patten, and how it is being touted in the mainstream media as shoring up Israel's propaganda narrative on this issue. I read the report in detail, and it contains no new evidence. Actually, technically, it contains no evidence at all, because it makes the distinction that it presents information instead, that, quote unquote, they received information. And the details in it are actually the recycling of prior debunked claims. Now, strikingly as well, what I found was that Pramila Patten, the UN official who led the report team, according to a contemporary Israeli press report from February, repeatedly expressed solidarity with Israel during her week-long visit to the settlements near Gaza in January. So, you know, for our readers and listeners, if you go to electronicintifada.net and read the article, you can see all the details there. It's on the front page of the site at the moment. But maybe just a question for you, Bryce. Have you seen how the corporate media has reported on this issue, and what is their attitude towards it?
Well, I've been watching, I've been following these stories of mass rape from the mainstream media for quite a while. I think your listeners and viewers might remember the fact that a big push for these stories came as part of Israel's justification for continuing the attack after the end of the first ceasefire, at the end of the first hostage deal. As that deal ended, Israel started ramping up its attacks again. And at the same time, you started seeing in the press these stories of mass rape, which are much like the people talk about the timing of the bombing of Rafah and the Super Bowl, and the only time the Israelis rescued a hostage was timed right after a commercial. The same way, I mean, this push on these stories was timed to be with the resumption of hostilities. And so these stories are largely based on about 4 or 5 different accounts. And each of these has various degrees of credibility. But the UN report, what they found, interestingly enough, was that they didn't even have access to video evidence that demonstrated the claims that they were making. They didn't have access to firsthand witnesses who were demonstrating the claims they were making. And if you actually read the report and you go to the findings sections, there's about 4 pages of findings. There's not a single footnote in that section that could link you, or that could link one of the claims that's made to a source, to an interview or a media report or a document or whatever. So the reader who is reading this report is left to simply take Pramila at her word. And another interesting fact about Pramila is that she was also one of the people who promoted the idea that Russians were using Viagra as a weapon of war during their invasion of Ukraine.
That same claim was also recycled from Hillary Clinton's State Department when they made that same false claim with respect to Libya in 2011 in order to gin up support for the Obama administration's regime change war in Libya. And then subsequently, U.S. intelligence officials and U.N. investigators said, we found no evidence for this. So it's, you know, we're told constantly, it's become this kind of refrain that sexual violence is endemic to war. Where there's war, there's sexual violence. And that's something we don't want to make light of. But by the same token, where there is war propaganda and atrocity propaganda. And that pattern keeps repeating. And with respect to this UN report, it's incredible to me, and this is something we also talk about in the article that we just published just before the live stream came on, that repeatedly in the report, Pramila Patton says that she had no investigative mandate, that most of the information she received came from so-called Israeli national institutions. When she toured the Israeli settlements in southern Israel near the Gaza boundary, she was accompanied, and this is in photos that were published by the Israelis, she was accompanied by Yossi Landau, the man from the Jewish extremist group Zaka that repeatedly fabricated atrocity propaganda about murdered babies and children and about a fetus being cut out of its mother's stomach, debunked stories that we have talked about on the live stream before. And she also says in the report that the UN team did what they call a medico-legal assessment, meaning sort of a looking for medical evidence in countless photos and videos of rape and found none. That's stated in the report. They saw no video showing a sexual assault taking place. This is all in the report. And yet, the media spin on this report, and very importantly, as Asa mentioned, the UN report states that several of the most widely cited incidents of claimed sexual assault are unfounded, including one story that has been repeated ad nauseum in practically every press report, including and especially the New York Times report, the infamous New York Times report led by Jeffrey Gettelman back in December. And this is the claim that two teenage girls were found raped and murdered in Kibbutz Be'eri. And the UN report says this is unfounded. And also, The Intercept, doing its own reporting in the last couple of days, also said categorically that this report is unfounded and that officials in Kibbutz Be'eri have categorically denied this and other allegations of sexual assault. And yet, the media is spinning this UN report as if it bolsters and confirms Israel's claims. How is that possible? Did they not read the same report we read?
Well, you know, there's no good reason to expect them to have actually read the report. I mean, these reports aren't designed to be read and critically examined. They're designed to have a conclusion that can be quoted in a media report that will advance the interest of the Israeli state. If you actually look at the report, a lot of it is them going through and talking about how they couldn't find any evidence. A lot of that is debunking some of the more lurid claims that were made by media reports. A lot of it is talking about how or justifying the reasons why they haven't yet found any victims for this. But the report's conclusions were written, it seems, in a completely separate vacuum than the actual body of the report. If the report's conclusions were to reflect the actual evidence that they found, it would have looked a lot differently. Journalists, you know, they don't need to read the report. All they need to know is that there's a report from someone that their editor believes is credible and that they can just quote word from word from that report, regardless of whether or not it makes sense or it's coherent or if it adds up. And so that's really how this pipeline works. You have media reports based on unverified sources, and then though you have an organization that makes a report based on these media sources saying that, well, now it's in a report, so now it's true. and then you have more media outlets reporting on that report. It's a very horrific circle that they have there.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the points that the Twitter user Zay Squirrel has made, who's along with us independent journalists, EI and the Grey Zone and Mondo Weiss. Zay Squirrel, I mean, we've talked about Zay Squirrel before, Twitter user with a squirrel avatar. You know, we don't know who they are, but they are, you know, they are a very established Twitter user, a very popular Twitter user, who has actually unearthed some new findings that no one else has come up with before. And Zay Squirrel has made this same point that you're making, that it's kind of a self-repeating narrative. It's being fed.
Hold on, because I know the point you want to make, but I actually want to show, because it's quite funny, this. Tamara, let's put up the headline that appears in Haaretz today. Can we do that? Yeah, so this is a story that was published in Haaretz, which is considered the respectable newspaper of record in Israel. The unhinged denialist frenzy around Hamas's sexual violence on October. And so this piece is attacking those of us who have questioned this narrative and pointed out the complete lack of evidence for it. Let's focus in on that one paragraph, Tamara. And I'll just read this for those who are listening. And this is from Haaretz. Relying mostly on one another as sources, why bother with exhaustively documented information from people on the ground when you can conjure up your dogma from thousands of miles away? Groups such as The Intercept, Mondo Weiss, Electronic Intifada, and something called Yes, in an unhinged article written by an expert on bacon and junk food, try their best to conjure a conspiratorial swirl of doubts and delegitimization. Remember, just asking questions and doing my own research. So what this Haaretz writer is claiming is that The Intercept, Mondo Weiss, the Electronic Intifada, and others who have debunked the mass rapes claim, really, we don't have anything to back that up. We're all just citing each other and going around in a circle. And ignoring, documented information from people on the ground. What do you make of that, Bryce? Is that a fair description of reality?
Well, I actually read this article this morning, and I did a semi-detailed Twitter thread talking about it. I went through and looked at what they actually had to criticize about the article or about the outlets that they're attacking here. And much like the Washington Post article attacking truthers, this article doesn't actually link to any of these outlets or anything they have to say. They don't address a single specific claim that any of these outlets make. All they do is they again, seem to want to dissuade people from reading these outlets and dissuade people from even looking at what these outlets have to say. And the idea that, oh, they're just all citing each other, that's how journalism operates. Different people find different information and they put it together in a coherent narrative. But it's also hypocritical, because what they're doing is they're simply citing these reports on sexual violence that, again, just cite media reports without any evidence. And so it's just completely ridiculous. You can look at this article, you try to find something that they disagree with about. From you, from Mondo Weiss, from Gray Zone, from Yes, which featured an excellent article about these topics. These are detailed articles with dozens of citations, with several claims that can be fact-checked. You can either say that this is true or this is false, but what they do is they say, well, you know, all these outlets are just lunatic, crazy. They might as well call them truthers or Holocaust denials, because the goal is the same. They want readers and the general public to hear these outlets' names, associate them with a negative sentiment, and then avoid them. And that's what this article is designed to do.
Yeah, and let's just show. Sorry, Asa. I was going to show the Brett Stevens article. Should we just do that quick?
Yeah.
Because it's in the same realm. And this is an article that appeared in the New York Times by their columnist, Brett Stevens, who is well known as an extreme right-wing supporter of Israel and a New York Times columnist. And as you can see, it's called the New Rape Denialism. And can we just show the first couple of paragraphs of that piece? Because what he writes is extraordinary. In the first two paragraphs, I'll just read the second paragraph. He says, Hamas denies that its men sexually assaulted Israelis, calling the charges lies and slanders against the Palestinians and their resistance. And Hamas's fellow travelers and useful idiots in the West, that presumably means journalists who actually do journalism, most of them self-described progressives, I guess that's the confirmation he's talking about us, parrot that denialism in the face of powerful and deeply investigated evidence of widespread rapes documented most recently in a United Nations report released on Monday. Okay, so what does he link to as the examples of powerful and deeply investigated evidence? If we actually click on the links, let's take a look. Yeah, go ahead and click on those links, Tamara. Yeah, that one. You can see he's linking to the debunked and fraudulent New York Times article that we've talked about already so many times, and to the UN report that we've just discussed. So again, they're going full throttle in attacking the journalists and the messengers and trying to dissuade people from actually reading any of the journalism.
Yeah, it's like this, it's this sort of self-repeating pattern, right? It's been laundered from the Israeli government into the New York Times and now into the UN system. Because, you know, unlike our articles, the difference between our articles and the New York Times' article, and even this UN report, is that we cite all our evidence. We're very, very specific. You know, we always provide sources for what to back up what we're saying, whereas even this UN report is making assertions and specifically saying that they don't have evidence, that this is not evidence, it is information received, and they won't even confirm who the information is received from, although it's very clear that the vast majority of it at least is coming from the Israeli government or Israeli national institutions, as they claim, as they put it in the report.
No, it's a very strange thing. Again, this article, this New York Times article, was also cited in that Aretz piece. It was also held up as an example of serious investigative reporting. And interestingly enough, they say that the only gripe that people who criticize the New York Times article have is a distinction between systematic mass rape and incidental instances of sexual violence. But I mean, if you even look at what The Intercept reported about The Daily, the New York Times' own fact checkers not being able to verify the claims in this article, I mean, that should shut that down immediately. But who knows if this Haaretz writer read the article or read anything about the article or was just given a series of links and just told to attack these guys. But the idea that all these reports will just link to each other and any example of a false claim can just be hand-waved away because of the other reports that are of course, you know, serious and well-researched. But if you look at each of these individual reports, they really fall apart upon closer scrutiny. And anyone trying to make claims should be held to the standard of evidence. An extreme claim should be held to the level of extreme evidence. Here, there are extreme claims being made and very, very minuscule evidence being presented. And I think that should give anyone pause. It's not what the Haaretz calls a conspiratorial frenzy. That's the term that they use. It's just people reading, again, at a 10th grade level. If you're able to do that, then you can easily figure out what the facts are.
Yeah, I'm going to assert that the fact that we're seeing this article, the article in Haaretz attacking us by name, along with other independent outlets, and the Brett Stevens piece clearly referring to us, although he doesn't mention our outlets by name, as a sign of panic and as a sign of recognition of the failure of this narrative. You know, again, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and even Haaretz, they don't go after people like us unless we are really starting to damage their ability to push this propaganda off without challenge.
And just to remind our listeners and viewers that the central problem that Brett Stevens and Haaretz are ignoring about this New York Times article, I mean, among many, is that the very fact that the woman at the center of that article, Gal Abdush, her family, you could see in that photo there, the head of that article, have said that the New York Times reporters misled them, that Anat Schwartz, the main reporter on the ground, misled them as to the nature of this article, and that they are insistent that their daughter was not raped before she was killed, that Gal Abdush was not raped before she was killed, despite the fact that is the central claim in this article, you know, making these insinuations that she was raped by Hamas, that her family is saying that did not happen, and now the other two women in pinpointed in this story.
The two teenage girls who allegedly were raped and murdered, and The Intercept has confirmed. And this was first reported by Mondo Weiss back at the beginning of December, that the story of the two teenage girls raped and murdered in Be'eri, and it was a claim that was made by an Israeli army medic, remember. So this is somebody who is involved in the part of the military that's engaging in genocide. Back in December, Mondo Weiss showed how this story couldn't have happened, that there were no two victims that fit that description in Be'eri, in Kibbutz Be'eri. And now, as The Intercept has reported, the authorities in Kibbutz Be'eri have confirmed that this did not happen. So it's all falling apart. And also, I mean, we could go on about this, but I want to ask Bryce about some of the other issues he's involved in. But I'll just say that with Anat Schwartz, one of the New York Times journalists, the novice journalist who has put on this particular story, and I don't think we had a chance to talk about this on the live stream because of the timing. I think it came out the same day that we did last week's live stream, that as The Intercept reported, she spoke at length in Hebrew to a podcast in Israel about the reporting of this story. And she revealed in that they called up every single emergency room or specialized facility in Israel that's charged with caring for victims of sexual assault, and they called the rape crisis line in southern Israel. They checked with all these institutions, and every single one of them told them, we did not have a single report of sexual assault or rape on October 7th. Not one. That should have alerted the editors at the New York Times that the story here was not one of mass sexual and violence, of mass sexual violence, but one of massive fraud. And they should have then said, wait a minute, let's stop and let's find out what's going on. Instead, what they did is, okay, you found no victims, you searched every possible place in Israel where there could be victims, and you didn't find any, then you got to manufacture some victims. And that's exactly what the New York Times ended up doing.
Yeah, can I just add a word about the motive of this as well, Ali, before you sort of transition to the other issues? It's very striking. Israel's UN ambassador, Gilad Erdan, is saying this week, he's making direct threats against the UN. And what he said in a statement this week is, quote, the meaning of a ceasefire is to lengthen the suffering of the hostages. Any call for a ceasefire is blatant support for Hamas to continue their sexual violence. So in other words, Israel is trying to smear those of us calling for an end to its genocide in Gaza as rape apologists. So that is the reason why this campaign is being, you know, manufactured, why this fabricated claim has gone out, you know. And we've seen that, you know, there was a report about this in the Gray Zone, the latest report in the Gray Zone about this, the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C. is also pushing this line about to emphasize that rape by Hamas took place in order to persuade, to push back against the growing calls around the world for an end to, for a ceasefire in Gaza and an end to the genocide. So that's what this is all about at the end of the day.
Yeah, but before we move on, I'd love to hear Bryce's reaction to this particular story that they focus tested what messaging would work best in terms of this. Bryce, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, this guy who's in charge of this focus testing, according to this Gray Zone article, is a man named Frank Luntz, who is a longtime Republican pollster who's found good ways to sell horrible policy to the American public, finding which phrases or which words elicit the largest emotional reaction. And he was used to help push through Bush administration policies like the invasion of Iraq. And he was, he's one of these longtime blob goons who's just doing the bidding of evil. And now he seems to be back at it by figuring out the best way to convince people in America that they need to support Israel. You see all these terms that they're using, you know, holding Hamas accountable. This is our 9/11. It's a war for humanity. I mean, these phrases don't come out of nowhere. The public relations industry for the last 100 years has been one of the most sophisticated industries in public opinion and public manipulation. You don't become a billion-dollar industry by not doing anything useful, or at least useful to someone. And they find the ability to conduct these focus tests and target the messaging for maximum potency to be extremely useful. This campaign of genocide is bolstered by this lab-tested, focus-tested propaganda. And there's another graphic on this in this article that shows the impact of certain phrases that describe what's going on in or what happened in Israel. And as you see, raped civilians and massacred civilians had the most reaction from the public. And so I'm sure after these focus tests were conducted, the Israeli propaganda strategy adjusted accordingly. I mean, why wouldn't it? That's their job. So again, this just shows the degree to which all of us, especially in America, are subjected to constant propaganda that is designed, tailor-made, to get Americans to support this genocide. And again, like I said earlier, it's not about, you know, people who do the reading, people who follow the news every day. It's not about people like you or me who try and evaluate the facts on their merits. This is for the general public. This is for people who are too busy to sit down and read 14 electronic intifada articles a day to figure out what's really going on. If you're an average person and someone tells you that there are raped civilians and we have to go stop them, well, then your natural reaction is going to be, well, obviously I support this. And that's how evil manifests itself, and that's how it persists.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you. And I know that we're going to come back to this topic. It's not going to go away because the propaganda is necessary to Israel and the genocide. So we're going to have to keep debunking it and pushing back on it. But while we still have you, Bryce, I want to talk about some of the other issues that you've written about and have been involved in addition to your contributions for fairness and accuracy in reporting. You are a doctoral student and an organizer at Indiana University in Bloomington. And in January, you wrote about the situation at Indiana University for us at the Electronic Intifada, where your friend and mentor, Professor Abdul Qadir Sinno, was suspended. He is a tenured professor in political science, and you wrote, his removal is not only an attack on free speech and academic freedom, but it is designed to suppress pro-Palestine speech at a time when Palestinians are suffering one of the most devastating attacks in their history. And it's more important than ever for Americans to speak out against injustice in Palestine. And Professor Sinnoh was suspended in December over supposed mistakes on a form he filled out to reserve a room for a speaking event featuring the author Miko Peled. You wrote also that there is good reason to suspect that Sinnoh's targeting has less to do with minor bureaucratic formalities and more to do with his role in assisting movements for justice on campus. Can you bring us up to date regarding this situation and what the reaction has been at Indiana University?
Well, this, as you said, it was a very troubling situation to have, again, an important professor, an important member of our community being barred from his activism over what appears to be political reasons. I don't think anyone seriously believes that the university was very concerned about, again, these minor bureaucratic errors, allegedly. What they're doing is they're creating an environment where people are afraid to speak out, where people know that if they step out of line, they could get the eye of the university on their backs. Now, they might not have any sanction levied against them, but dealing with that is difficult. And people don't want to do that. So creating this chilling effect has been their goal. But there has been a lot of pushback from the community, from the faculty, from other students at the university. It's pretty clear what's going on, and people are trying to fight against it. Even professors who aren't diehard supporters of anti-imperialist movements are very concerned that one of their colleagues can be summarily dismissed for what appear to be politically motives. They're very concerned, and so they're organizing about it. And it's very heartening to see the petitions for Sinnoh and the petitions for Samia Halabi, who was removed from the university's upcoming art exhibits for similar political reasons. It's heartening to see that those actions are galvanizing the public, the university community, into serious action. Now, one thing we've learned since Sinnoh's dismissal was that after, about 2 to 3 weeks after the Miko Peled event, the university entered into a partnership with the Anti-Defamation League and other pro-Israel organizations to help combat anti-Semitism on campus, so to speak. And this seems to be in response to a letter from our congressman, Jim Banks, who sent a letter to the university demanding that they investigate anti-Semitism, demanding that they take some steps to make the environment safer for pro-Israel views. And so this happened in late November, and Sinnoh's dismissal came in December. Now, there's no direct evidence tying these two together, but given the issues at play and given the pressure campaign that the university was embarking upon, it's difficult not to see these two things as linked. And the university seems to be doubling down on its relationship with both the military-industrial complex and the Israel lobby. And you can see it in their investments. You can see it in the companies that they have speaking on campus. But again, all of this is an educational experience for both the students and the faculty. The biggest education they're getting isn't necessarily in the classroom, but it's learning about what these institutions that they're operating in, how they function, what pressures are acting on them, and how they can fight against it. Many students I've seen have told me that they were interested in some other career path beforehand, but watching what happened in Palestine, watching the university's response to Sinnoh, watching the university's crackdown on pro-Palestine speech, it's radicalized them. It's made them decide that they want to fight for liberation for all. And I think that is what organizers should be trying to do, trying to funnel this outrage, trying to funnel this confusion and this stupefaction into serious organization building. There's only one way that any liberation struggle has ever succeeded. That's by people getting organized. And so that's what I hope that we're seeing here.
And we certainly hope that too. And you are involved in some of that organizing across Indiana. And we know that the situation at Indiana University is not dissimilar to what's happening at campuses across the country, where there is repression, there is smearing of anyone who speaks about Israel's genocide of Palestinians as an anti-Semite, and that this is being really driven from the top down with members of Congress pushing for McCarthyite witch hunts and smear campaigns at campuses across the country. There's a great deal more to talk about on all of this, and I hope we can have you back to do that soon, Bryce. And in the meantime, you are doing incredible work at FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. People can find your analyses there. And I read your piece on the coverage of Palestine and Gaza, but you also have really good analyses of how the media act as a propaganda mouthpiece on a whole range of issues, including Ukraine and Russia, among others. So I really hope that people will take a look at that, and that we would love for you to write more at the Electronic Intifada on all of these issues. So I hope you'll do that too. And how can people find you on social media?
Well, I mostly can be found on Twitter at the Green BJ, Green with an E at the end. I also have a Substack that's linked on my Twitter, and that's mostly where I sit.
Yeah, and if people just search for your name, Bryce Green, they're going to find a lot of your writing and articles, because I know I did when I did that. And so I hope they will become more aware of your work, and thank you so much for coming on today, Bryce. We're going to leave it there, and
thanks,
hope we'll continue the conversation soon. Thank you.
Absolutely.
All right. I think,
that was amazing. Oh, thank you so much. Bryce, thank you, Bryce, and thank you to Asa and you, Ali. Phenomenal segment. And of course, just as a reminder, we always edit these segments into standalone little pieces. So look for those on YouTube and on our social media as well. Thank you all for continuing to tune in. You're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. We're going to turn to John and the latest resistance news. Hi, John.
Hi, guys.
Hi, John.
It was good to hear from Dr. Ali and hear
Hi,
from
John.
Bryce.
Yeah, absolutely. John, the Palestinian resistance in Gaza has been involved in a fierce battle the past 2 weeks in Zeytun in the center of Gaza City. You did talk about it last week and showed us a field report from Islamic Jihad that said that they had used an exploded Israeli bomb. Let's start there. Update the story for us and talk about what's happening in Zeytun.
Yeah, so last week, we talked about how there was an Islamic Jihad field report that was posted that the fighters explained that they had used a unexploded Israeli bomb that was sent. This is what the message said. It said, in a complex engineering operation, we trapped a Zionist force in a precise ambush inside a building that was booby-trapped using an F-16 missile launched by the enemy towards civilian homes. It did not explode. Our engineers worked to activate it and detonate it in the vicinity of the Dawla Junction south of the Al Zeytun neighborhood in Gaza City. And we reported just on that field report, but the next day after our show, Islamic Jihad released a video of that operation. So maybe we can go to number one here, Tamara. So this is you can see here, we're looking at video from a building nearby. We can see an Israeli soldier outside of a Merkava tank. And Islamic Jihad identifies that building as an Israeli position during the Battle of Zeytun. This has been a two-week operation where Israel reinvaded Gaza City. Zeytun is one of the busiest neighborhoods in Gaza City and one of the areas that the Israelis claimed that they had operational control over months ago, but we've shown you week after week on this show that that's not the case. And you see the beginning of this complex operation. An RPG is fired at the building with the Israeli force in it. And then we can see here the F-16 missile is detonated in a massive explosion of the size that we have not seen before, and gives you a sense of both what it's like when these bombs are dropped on Palestinian civilians, as they have been throughout the war, but the impact of the fact that the Israelis have carried out 30,000 airstrikes using fighter jets, dropping munitions like this. So the names of these bombs, they get different names depending on the guidance system that they're using or which country is using them. But essentially, there's three types of bombs that are being dropped on Palestinians. There's Mark II, Mark III, and Mark IV bombs. The Mark II is 500 pounds. The Mark III is 1,000 pounds. And the Mark IV is 2,000 pounds. In each of these weapons, in the 500-pound bomb, there's more than 200 pounds of high explosives inside the munition. In the 1,000-pound bombs, there's 500 pounds of high explosives. And the 2,000-pound bombs have 950 pounds of high explosives. Now, all of these bombs that are being dropped on Gaza have a certain dud rate. The numbers are kept classified, but we know that that the bombs, although they've been proved in recent years, going back into previous decades, that the dud rate could be as much as a third of the weapons. And so even if you're correcting that statistic, what we're seeing happening in Gaza right now is scores, many, if not hundreds, of these unexploded bombs that are all throughout civilian areas. And because of the size of the bombs, they can't be moved by hand. They require heavy equipment to move the unexploded ordnance. So what we're seeing here is Islamic Jihad actually not moving the bomb, re-engineering to explode the munition. And the Israelis admitted casualties on this operation that I reported last week, where they said that there was at least seven injured and at least two additional killed, both a platoon commander and a company commander were killed in this operation. So this is the first we've seen of a missile be reused in this way. We've seen field reports of them being used, but this is the first time that we've seen the weapon detonated like this. But this is a clue about what is coming for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because there are these dud bombs throughout the Gaza Strip that can be then reappropriated by the resistance and sent back to Israelis, which is something that we have seen in the past since Operation Cast Lead, after Cast Lead in 2008-2009, the Qassam Brigades and Hamas set up an unexploded ordnance unit that went around and collected these weapons, because they have to be removed from houses before people can move back into their homes, or construction can happen in their homes. So there's a massive cleanup, a dangerous cleanup effort ahead in the Gaza Strip. But each of these weapons can be then used by the resistance. Really, we're looking at a generation of capacity that's being dropped on Gaza and unexploded. And just to give you a sense of how many of these, we saw in the congressional testimony the other day by the Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin in that congressional hearing, where he said that more than 25,000 women and children have been killed in Gaza, according to American intelligence numbers. At that same hearing, we learned that 21,000 bombs had been sent to Israel since October 7th, just since October 7th, 21,000. And we know that according to the Israelis, there's been 29,000 airstrikes using these munitions on Gaza. So just a little cause and effect there of the direct relationship between American weapons and the catastrophe that's happening in the Gaza Strip right now. So let's go maybe to number three here, Tamara, because this is another type of operation that the Qassam, all of these videos from the last week, all of them from the Battle of Zaytun. And here we see the Qassam brigades monitoring an IDF armored unit and underground setting, setting a Shawaz device underground, remotely detonated. The fighters are safe in a tunnel and detonating above ground against an Israeli force. And we're seeing now pictures from the area showing smoke from the burning vehicles that were hit by that ambush. And again, this is something that the tunnels are able to do. You can stack munitions inside the tunnels and detonate them. You can also lure the Israelis into booby-trapped buildings, which is what happened yesterday in Khan Yunis when the Israelis admitted to 13 casualties in a booby-trapped tunnel in Khan Yunis. And we haven't seen a lot of tunnel operations. And as I said earlier on in the war, the only way that the Israelis are going to achieve their goals that they set out for Gaza is if we see a lot of underground operations, because we know that there's hundreds of kilometers of tunnels that the Palestinians are using. Well, yesterday, the Israelis said that they just finished closing off the tunnel that we showed you on this program in early December, the tunnel in the north. The attack tunnel that was so large that cars were driving through it. The Israelis only yesterday finished with concrete, with explosives, sealing that tunnel, whatever that is, 3 full months later. And that gives you a sense of how challenging a task it is and how we're not seeing that happening throughout the Gaza Strip, because the tunnel that they closed in the north, that tunnel is not in a built-up area, so the Israelis were actually able to work in that area in relative freedom compared to the other places that they would have to operate to contain this tunnel network. And so we heard, of course, that they were going to flood the tunnels. We haven't heard much about that because it obviously doesn't work. And we know from this tunnel example in the north that it takes them months to just close a single tunnel, and they're not closing the routes into that tunnel. We know that from the Israeli captives that have been released, that the tunnel network in Gaza is effectively a spider web. It's not straight corridors between two places. So you can see the fighters wiring in this video here below ground, and now they're seeing a cameraman above ground. And again, we are seeing in these operations multiple levels of communication, and then these videos are being released immediately to the public. So we're not seeing anything like the comms network being shut down during this massive operation into Zaytun. So let's go to the next one here, Tamara, because we have another way that Palestinians are setting bombs. This is a Shawaz above ground. This is an explosively formed penetrator, which is used against armored vehicles. We can see a fighter here moving to an embankment that the Israelis have created on this street in order to protect their armored vehicle corridors. And we see a fighter moving with the Shawaz device out to the roadside, and then fighters above ground watching from a window as the device is set off against Israeli armored corridor, armored columns. And if we watch just one more time when we're going through, we can see this at 10 seconds of this video here. You can see if you look at the building that's ahead there, that building is still smoking. So these are active battlefields that the Palestinians are operating on. And the Israelis are believing that by sending a belt of fire in advance of their armored vehicles, that they're preventing the resistance from operating. But it's clear from these videos that that's not the case. Instead, they're ending up targeting civilians that are in these homes, not the fighters that are participating in this battle. And the Battle of Zaytun was a division level battle. It was more than 10,000 Israeli soldiers invading Gaza City in an area that the Israelis said that they had already cleared Qassam fighters from. And they needed 10,000 soldiers and a 2-week operation. And according to their objectives of digging up the tunnel network that splits the Gaza Strip, that carries from the north to the south of the Gaza Strip, they weren't able to carry out that operation of that tunnel operation. So it appears that the resistance in Zeytun prevented that, and the Israelis withdrew on the weekend. And that's when we saw what Nora was reporting on at the beginning of this show, the brutal atrocities of killing Palestinian civilians who are bound with handcuffs, bound and then run over while alive by tanks. Just horrific, horrific finds that are that we see, we only see in Zeytun because the Israelis pulled out. These horrors are waiting in places that people haven't come back home to, which is a whole other level of this conflict that we are going to see once the Israelis pull back and Palestinians are allowed to go back to their homes. The murder of civilians that we've, you know, that Nora documented in the news report really well. Let's do number five here, Tamara. So this is a Sarai al-Quds operation. You can see them watching an armored bulldozer here from, I don't know how, for people that are listening, we're looking at an armored bulldozer that's only feet away from the fighters. And here we have Sarai al-Quds, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad. We can see this unit, and one of the things about the Sarai al-Quds videos is that they tend to follow the fighters longer than the Qassam videos, which are more tightly edited. So we actually can see the fighters move from their positions inside a house where they monitored the bulldozer and then exit the house safely, moving through walls, moving under brush, and then attacking that vehicle that they were right beside in the building from an angle that's more advantageous than firing from the position they were in. All of these things pointing to, again, there doesn't appear to be any degradation to the overall operations of the resistance. And now we're watching an Islamic Jihad fighter, a set of fighters here laying a minefield using various types of explosives, moving through the rubble that Israel believes, because they've destroyed this building, that it's no longer of military purpose, but the fighters are using it, using the undergrowth and wiring, and the fighter here is holding what looks to be a claymore mine, which is an anti-personnel mine that would be used within the minefield. And you can see the fighter here burying this roadside bomb in the foliage and creating a minefield. And so we've seen this in the field reports when the fighters talk about minefields and detonating minefields among Israeli forces. But this is one of the first videos that we've actually seen them, the detail that goes into laying that operation. And again, you can see that they start this operation within feet of the Israeli troops. So there's nothing like clearing, which is what the term that the Israelis use, that they're clearing these areas. There's clearly that's not the case. And we can see with this significant roadside charge that's laid here, you can see the fighters here. We're watching them climb out the windows, stay along the walls for protection against the drones that are constantly watching from the air. We're seeing them now move through holes in buildings that they've knocked out, mouse holes to move around. And then he'll move into the street here and fire. And maybe we can switch to the next one after he fires here tomorrow. The fighter moves. It's unclear the result of that. Now we're seeing here is a Qassam tunnel operation in Zeytun, and we're seeing the fighter poke the last foot of topsoil off and expose the attack tunnel here. And he pops up for people listening within, again, 25 feet of an armored vehicle and fires a Yassin at him. And so this is an interesting view. We've seen a number of these tunnel operations, but we can see with this footage, the last that they don't dig these tunnels until they're ready to be used in the operation. Once the Israeli position is set, they can see through their tunnel network, which they have mapped and the Israelis have not, and see where the best place to exit the tunnel to attack Israeli forces. And this is something that you see in all kinds of Israeli field reports of their own, talking about fighters coming up behind them, coming up through areas that they believed that they had cleared and attacking them from behind. So we're seeing in this Battle of Zaytun a 360 degrees ambush of Israeli forces, and you're seeing it fought in three dimensions. You're seeing it fought from above with shooters using elevated positions to fire from above. You're seeing them attack on the ground level, and now we're seeing them attacking underground using the attack tunnel, which is covered. And then the Israelis have the decision once this tunnel has hit this tank, which is too close for the tank's active protection system to engage. So all of the vaunted Israeli technical superiority is nullified by the Palestinians' ability to use tunnels and to use their homemade RPG rounds that are still not showing any sign of depleted resources. This is Israel reinvading Gaza City after 2 months, and the fighters in Gaza City are still showing up with the same weapons, using appropriate weapons for the situation. There doesn't appear to be any shortage of these in these videos that we're watching. And again, these videos that I'm showing you today are all from the past week. We're still covering just the day-to-day battle on the ground. Once the ceasefire takes hold, we can maybe rearrange some of these videos and show them in themes. But at this point, we're still covering the day-to-day resistance. So we can see a tank hit there. And we saw footage. We won't show it on our show to keep these videos up. But we saw footage leaked today or shown by the Israelis on their TikTok channel of a Yassin round penetrating one of their armored vehicles and clearly very seriously wounded soldiers inside those vehicles. And so the vehicles are being penetrated by these rounds, especially in the case that we're seeing here with something that is so close. And again, the fighters are returning to their base safely. These are not martyrdom missions. Maybe we can go to number 7 here, Tamara. Because we see the Yassins being used in all different ways. Again, the using the Yassin 105, the most dangerous of their anti-tank weapons, light, portable, easy to use. And we're seeing them use the undergrowth here. We're watching them walk between buildings through holes in the buildings and coming out in firing positions. This one looks like it's about 100 feet away from the vehicle. And you can see there the Yassin round flying through the air. So they've got cameraman, multiple Yassin shooters.
Welcome back. And that was a detailed report on developments in Gaza from Electronic Intifada. That's going to conclude our program for today. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network. And that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal, blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And this is the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. And we have been here with you, and of course, we're going to continue these broadcasts and read the Pan-African Newswire. You can also read other information from the Pan-African Newswire over the internet at Facebook, Twitter. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week. We'll leave with Etta James.
In late 1959, Etta left Modern Records and moved to Chicago with her then-husband, Harvey Fuqua. To end her contract with Modern Records, Etta and Harvey recorded We're in Love and their first recording for the Chess label titled If I Can't Have You.
Love, we're in love.
I know
that you know that I am in love with you. Won't you give me a chance to prove my love to you?
I know
that
you know
that I am
in love with.
you. We know that they know that we are so in love. You know. I know. You love me too.
Baby, I want you to give me just one more chance to prove my love to you.
I know
that you know that I am in love with you.
I know. You know. They know. We know that we're in love.
Before signing with the Chess Records family in 1960, during her transition from Modern Records on the West Coast to Chess Records in Chicago, Miss Peaches sang backup vocals for guitarist Chuck Berry. The songs include Almost Grown and the legendary rock anthem, Back in the USA.
Whoa, whoa. You know I'm almost grown.
Whoa, whoa.
Yeah, and I'm doing all right in school.
Nice.
They ain't said I broke no rules.
Nice.
I ain't never been in Dutch. I don't browse around too much. Don't bother me, leave me alone. Anyway, I'm almost grown. I don't run around with no mob. Got myself a little job. I'm gonna buy me a little car. Drive my girl in the park. Don't bother, sleep alone. Anyway, we almost grown.
Whoa.
1960, after signing with Argo Records, the subsidiary label to Chess Records, producer Leonard Chess decided to tone down Etta's rough and tough sound due to him believing that Peaches could be a successful crossover artist. For her first recording session, Chess added orchestra arrangements to songs like All I Could Do Was Cry, co-written by Berry Gordy, At Last, and Trust in Me, which became hits on both the R&B and pop charts. Here's Miss Peaches with Sunday Kinda Love, her big hit At Last, and Trust in Me.
Sunday kind of love, a love to last past Saturday night, and I'd like to know it's more than love at first sight, and I want a Sunday kind of love. Can't seem to find somebody, someone to care, and I'm on a lonely road that leads to nowhere. I need a Sunday kind of do my Sunday dreaming, oh yeah, and all my Sunday scheming, every minute, every hour, every day. Oh, I'm hoping to discover a certain kind of lover. Someone to enfold, to keep me warm when Mondays and Tuesdays grow cold. Love for all my life to have and to hold. Oh, and I want a Sunday kind of love. Oh, Monday, Tuesday.